You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel.
Around the world, many places are thought of as haunted. From houses, hotels, hospitals, and even underground train stations. Yet could a person actually be haunted? Could you find yourself in a situation that it didn't matter where you lived, what you did, or who you had around you? Something always reaches through from beyond. My guest today is M.G. Stevens, a woman who has lived a remarkable life surrounded by entities. She joins me to discuss her new book, The Boogeyman Chronicles. In MG's book, the family's struggles, encounters, and experiences are chronicled over the last 40 years, and it covers some disturbing encounters. But as always, before we get to the spooky stuff, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or clicking the link on the show notes. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. A big thank you to Elaine, Nicola, and Mary, my latest Patreons. And as always, thank you for your support. Every Patreon makes my job easier and easier. Thank you. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. And please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters YouTube channel, almost at 1,500 subscribers. So thank you to each and every one of you that subscribe to that channel. You can also find mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, updates, and also you can get yourself some Mysteries and Monsters merchandise from the tabs at the top of the page. As always, a massive thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork, to Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys for his production duties, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Some people long to be haunted, but after you hear my next guest, you should be careful what you wish for. My guest today is M.G. Stevens, a neurodivergent media and empath, and the author of The Boogeyman Chronicles, which lists her encounters that her and her family have had over the last 40 years, covering a wide range of phenomena. M.G., welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Delighted to speak with you today.
Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm often taken aback sometimes when I speak with people in this particular field that often I find it surprising that for many people, they often are really excited or interested in the paranormal. And then I see and read a story like yours, MG, and I think, there for the grace of God, go I, because it's one of the most challenging collections of encounters and experiences that I think I've ever read.
Mm. Yes, I've heard that before. it surprised me, you know, when I sat down and started to write all my encounters out, I thought, holy crap, I didn't do some stuff here, you know. it really did shock me. Because things happen to you and you kind of you file them away and you don't think about them too much because you push them away because you're just trying to get through life. And that's what I did. I just kind of pushed it back. And then I started writing and I thought, oh my goodness, I've been through some stuff. And basically the book started out where I was, I had started my own paranormal podcast called the Boogeyman Chronicles on YouTube. And I remember, you know, prior to this, I had been listening to a lot of paranormal podcasts and every single time I listened to one, you know, I would hear people say, oh, well, you know, I'm not crazy. I swear I'm not crazy. Or you're probably going to think I'm crazy. And I thought, my goodness, we have to stop this talk. We have to stop this belief of being terrified to share our encounters. It broke my heart to hear all these people, you know, terrified to share their own encounters. People saying, well, you know, I never spoke of this. It's kind of plagued me. And I realized that paranormal PTSD really is a real thing. You know, the body, whether or not you believe in the paranormal, the body and the brain see it as a trauma, you know, a trauma experienced, and it's storing that trauma, and that, you know, that person is carrying that with them their whole lives. And it broke my heart to hear all these people just terrified that someone was going to think they're crazy. And I thought, we need to create a better safe spaces for people who have had paranormal encounters. And we need to normalize paranormal encounters, you know, and take the giggle factor out of them, as how Terry Lovelace called it. We need to take the giggle factor out of stuff like this. We need to normalize it and make people feel safe and comfortable in sharing their encounters. And so when I started my own podcast and had people come on, as much as I didn't want to, I kept interjecting because I was like, oh, I've been through this. And oh, yeah, I've been through that. And I started realizing, okay, first of all, I'm interrupting my guest, which is horrible. And secondly, I started realizing, holy crap, I've been through some stuff. I think I need to write that book, because for so many years I had people tell me, they're like, oh, you know, Marie, because I wasn't super forthcoming about all the paranormal stuff that I've been through. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't think about it for some reason. And then I started talking to people. They were like, oh, Marie, you got to write that down. You got to write a book. And I was like, no, I don't. Yeah. And then I started realizing, oh man, I've been through some stuff, and you know, people don't really know who I am. They don't know what I've been through. So, I wrote this book to kind of accomplish a lot of things, you know, get this off my chest, for, you know, therapy for me, but, also an introduction to who I am and what I've been through, and also to kind of get the story out there, to kind of share with people, hey, look, you're not crazy. You know, I went through the same thing. I can't tell you how many books I read, paranormal books, where I was like, oh my gosh, I went through that same thing. So it made me feel like I wasn't, you know, it's that extra confirmation that, okay, I'm not crazy. Someone else went through this too. You know what I mean? So I wrote the book for several different reasons. And I just hope people read it and find solace or at least some entertainment in it, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, without wishing to sound like I was being cliche, as you've mentioned it there, I suppose when you look back on it, that point of your life where you decided to sit down and write about everything you'd been through, were you one of those people that goes through this process, MG, and thinks, well, this has been a form of therapy, and found it quite a positive experience? Because when you're reading about some of the things that you yourself have been through, and there are other books of this ilk where people have gone through some very traumatic experiences, both personally and in the paranormal, I would imagine that sometimes awakening some of those memories can be quite difficult, because I think when you've been through a lot in whatever kind of traumatic experiences you've had in life, often our brains are very good at kind of putting things out of the way to look after ourselves. And I would imagine that, did this book kind of reopen anything that you really weren't happy of revisiting, or are you quite blasé about it? Because the one thing I took from reading your story and your experiences is that you're one hell of a tough woman.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I haven't been told that before. I don't feel so tough sometimes, but yeah. All of it, to be quite honest with you. I mean, several things came up, and I had to talk to my therapist about some of this stuff. I was like, I forgot about this thing that happened to me. And she was like, wow. So, you know, yeah, a lot of these things that I had to revisit, you know, especially the, not just the paranormal stuff, but the you know, the physical abuse and mental, emotional abuse that I suffered at the hands of, you know, certain family members. Yeah. And it was difficult. I went through a lot of chronic illness. I went through a lot of anxieties and just a lot of stress. And yeah, I mean, I guess I am tough. I've been through a lot, but I am still here. So,
well, I'm glad to hear it. I think it is remarkable, even if you take all the paranormality out of your life, which is very difficult because a lot of it seems entwined regardless, because of the variety of locations you found yourself in and the challenges that you had in your family unit in your early years, especially. I think it's one of those things, because often certain people in life seem to attract the weird wherever they are, MG. And I think obviously both yourself and your mother have had this kind of connection with the other side. And I found it very interesting that regardless of everything that you were going through, it's almost as if it took
you to become a teenager before your mum thought that you were sort of ready to talk about these things in a proper way. So I'm really interested in the fact that you had to deal with so much weirdness as a toddler and as a young child before you got to that point, on top of all this thing, you know, with you bouncing around with the situations with your father and the like, and moving homes and, you know, the challenges that you had to face dealing with that, which I would imagine would have been an enormous strain without certain things popping up and bothering you every night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the you know, for me, my life getting through the everyday was difficult. And then I had to worry about the paranormal. And, you know, as a little kid, you know, as a toddler, I had no clue what was going on. I thought, God, am I nuts? You know, I thought it was crazy. Even as a little kid, I thought it was crazy. I thought, what is this? But I knew something was there. And you know, as the years went on and I got more of a clearer head about things, you know, I started to say, you know, because at first I didn't know what was happening. I just called the monsters. Okay, the monsters are back. The monsters are here. The foot monsters attacking my feet again. You know, the monsters are here. And then as I got a little bit older, I still remember I went to the library with my father's second wife, my first stepmother. I went to the library and I started to clue in. I thought, okay, maybe I'm dealing with this thing, these things called ghosts or spirits. So I then got a book and I showed it to her and I said, you know, this is what I'm going through. And she of course didn't believe it and totally dismissed it and said, no, there's no such thing. So I then was like, well, what do I do now? You know, I was really all on my own. I didn't have enough. I didn't really realize that the world of, you know, the paranormal, the stuff that I was going through of invisible monsters and tortures every night, you know, was the same as my mother's world of doing psychic readings. I had no idea it was the same world. So I went through most of my life clueless until I became a teenager and I started to clue in and I started to realize, oh, my mom is a psychic and I'm sensitive too. I know stuff and I'm seeing things and I'm feeling things and I'm picking up on entities. That was about 12, 13 when I started to really clue in like, oh, okay. And then, you know, kind of reluctantly became a Christian at 14. And then at 15, it really kind of hit me. I told my mom, I said, Mom, we're psychic. You know, this is what we do. This is who we are. And she's like, yeah. She's like, yeah, we're psychic. And I'm like, wow, okay. And then that's why I started realizing I inherited these things from my mother as well, because we are both neurodivergent and there is a very strong correlation between neurodivergence, autism, ADHD, dyspraxia, and all of those, and ESP. So she was neurodivergent and I was as well. And we were, you know, psychic for lack of a better word. And so, started to clue in because, I mean, a lot of Christians don't realize that the world of demons and angels and Jesus, you know, teletransporting himself, you know, that's the paranormal. And they don't realize that, you know, that's very much a part of the paranormal. It's just on this end. It's another branch of the same tree. And for me, you know, sitting in church, I mean, you can't go to a fundamentalist Christian-y, churchy church and not hear about demons and Jesus performing miracles and all of that. So when you hear that, you start to really clue in and you're like, oh, okay. So what I'm picking up on is a demon, a ghost, a thing or this or that. And you start to realize, oh, okay. I'm psychic. I'm sensitive. I pick up on these things. So it wasn't until I was about 15 that it really hit me who I was, what I was, and what I could do.
Yeah. I mean, I've spoken to people before who have been sensitive, so they consider themselves to be psychics, MG. I think you're probably the youngest person that can remember a paranormal experience. I know you mentioned it a couple of times in the book that people are amazed at your level of recall, even to this day, that you can remember. I think you were pointing out your father's awful home decor with a dreadful settee and carpet combination, which does sound a bit eye-opening. I think you were describing it as some kind of garish green combination. Yeah. But I was very interested because obviously, I think you were saying that your first sort of paranormal experience happened when you were sort of 2 or 3 years old, when you had this kind of realization that you were looking up at yourself that was looking down at yourself.
Yes, to this day, I still don't know what that was. And I talked to Paul Eno, mm-hmm. who, you know, a lot of you know Paul Eno. He's, you know, he's a pioneer in the paranormal. He's been at it for, you know, 40 plus, 50 plus years. The guy's, you know, he's seen it all. And I said, what the hell did I go through? And he was like, I don't know. He said, it sounds like a shifting identity point where in the multiverse, you and, you know, like you became split in some way. Mm-hmm. But I do recall that I was very, very young. I was able to stand up in my crib. And I remember I was holding on to the side. And I remember I had a very distinct memory of me looking up and seeing something and pointing up at it. But yet I remember me looking down at the sea, looking down at me standing up in the crib, looking down at the whole room. You know, later on, many years later, I told my mom, I said, Mom, did my room look like this? And she was like, how did you know that? You were a baby when we moved. And I said, I don't know. I just remember my room looking like this. I had a weird encounter. And she just went like, wow. And then about a year or so later, the same thing happened. It was Easter. I had my little Easter dress on and I was on my little purple tricycle, and my little sibling and my mother, they were trying to get me to hide, you know, like look for hidden eggs. And I think I needed a nap. I was very cranky that day, but I still remember I was on my tricycle and I remember looking up and pointing at something that no one else could see. But I remember looking down at me in that scene. I remember seeing everything. So to this day, I had two encounters like that, and I still have no clue what they actually were. So if anyone has any idea, please write me and let me know. Because I had rarely heard of encounters like that. Paul mentioned a few that he's heard that are similar. But yeah, I mean, I really to this day don't really know what that was.
Yeah, I think they're remarkable on a couple of aspects, really, because often if you speak to the average person, MG, that a lot of people don't remember much about being a small child. As you were saying there, my earliest memory is my third birthday, because I got a scooter for my third birthday and decided to get my mum up at 3 a.m. and and was just whizzing around the front room on this scooter that I was delighted with. And I also got a car transporter with a blue car and a red car on it. Now, I can hardly remember anything else over the next 5 years of my life, but for some reason, that third birthday at 3 a.m. has always stuck in my mind, you know, 40-odd years later. And yet, when you speak to most people, I think it's one of those things that a lot of people don't actually sort of think about a lot. They don't think, what's the earliest thing you remember? So I think when you read your book, it kind of shows that, as I said in the introduction, this has been going on for over 40 years and you're still here. And you're still dealing with this with a great deal of tenacity and good humor. And I think it's interesting for me that your very early experiences seem to be quite different, quite interesting, but quite positive. And it's interesting that as you grow, you kind of have that 10-year period from sort of being about 5 years old to 15. I think that you've got so many challenges going on that everything just gets really dark in regards to the paranormal experiences you encounter.
Yeah, you know, from 5 years old, I mean, there wasn't a day that passed that something didn't happen, that I wasn't creeped out by something. Whether I was at my mother's and we were in that sort of more rural setting, and I was outside playing, and it was literally daily. But you know, I can't. If I can't remember something, it's because it was so it was on a daily basis, and it was not something that was terrifying enough to where I was like, oh yeah, this thing attacked me. But I remember enough to know that it literally every single day whether I was at my father's and his wife's house, or I was at her mother's house in Miami, or I was at my mother's house, my mother's apartment, you know, condo duplex thing. And there was always something happening. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it got to the point where, you know, you just kind of had to ignore it because I wanted to play outside. And we lived in such a rural area that I know there was some sort of, you know, presence out in that area. And so every time I would play, I would go outside and there was a canal, and then there was the other side of the canal, and there was nothing but woods there for many years. And I remember looking over there and just knowing something was staring back at me, and I couldn't see anybody. And it maybe it was a skunk ape, maybe it was you know, the indigenous people, you know, their presence on the land, you know, they lived there. And so my mom had a few encounters with a native man, and it was just every day. But, you know, when you're a neurodivergent medium empath, you really can't turn it off. I mean, to be quite honest with you, it's just all the time. Your antenna is always off. So if nothing scary and terrifying is coming at you and attacking you, you're always picking up on some sort of low level something or other.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine that's just a challenge as it is. On top of everything else you have to deal with, it's almost like you're just being swamped by communications and messages. And I found it very interesting that it's not as though you kept being visited by the same kind of entity or ghost or whatever you want to call them, because that's the other thing about the book, MG. You don't try and label them. You just kind of say you don't know what some of these things were over the years. They just appeared. And you've given a few of them some interesting names. Obviously, I think most people can kind of find something in common with the first character I'd like to touch on, which is the foot monster. And I think this is one of those things that even if you're not a real believer in the paranormal, most people have these kind of feelings about this unnatural fear about if your foot's hanging out of your bed, something's going to grab hold of it. And for most people, it's just a silly idea. Unfortunately for you, there was something that enjoyed pulling your feet.
Yes, there was something that was in my stepmother's condo that was just relentless. It pursued me during the day. It bothered me during the day at times. And as soon as the lights went off, as soon as it got dark, I knew, okay, I'm going to be tortured tonight, because I was tortured every single night. I first went there to stay the weekend when I was about 2, and I officially moved away from there when I was about 9. I was just about to turn 9. And I went back again when I was about 14, 15. And whatever is in my stepmother's condo, it's still there. But this thing delighted, and I mean delighted, in torturing me every single night. And I'm talking about laying on the bed. I'm talking about whispering in my ear to where I could actually feel the breath on my face. I'm talking about strange sounds, kicking the bed and pulling the sheets off, and something with very long fingernails, jagged fingernails, used to pull at my feet. And I could feel it all night long. And so as a little 4-year-old kid, I thought, well, I'm going to put some socks on my feet. Maybe that'll help, you know, because I was desperate at this point. I kept telling my dad and my stepmom, I said, something's bothering me at night. And of course, they didn't believe anything. So they completely, you know, I was left to my own devices at that point. You know, I had no idea. So I thought, well, if I wear some socks, maybe it'll stop the foot monster. Maybe that'll be a deterrent. And so I wore socks, and I hate wearing socks even to this day, but I wore socks then because I thought, well, this is going to work. And it kind of did. It kind of stopped it. So, yeah. I didn't know what else to call it. I called it the foot monster because I was 4 years old. I didn't know what else to call it. And I remember telling that to my family, and they laughed and laughed. I'm like, it's not funny. It's true. This thumb's grabbing my feet. Of course, they thought, you know, oh, she's just making stuff up, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose this is, it's a very difficult part of the book, your early life to read, even, you know, on a personal level, MG, because there's a lot going on. And I think a lot of us out there have had situations in our family lives that have been quite challenging. And we look back now and we sometimes think, well, how did that happen? And yet, I think for yourself, you've got all this going on. And often when you speak to people who have had experiences at such a young age, the one thing that is often a solace for them is that there is a member of the family that's there for them or believes them or has this connection. And yet, regardless of the fact that your mum seemed to have been keeping everything she was doing and everything she experienced and everything she knew to herself for whatever reason, maybe because, as we've said earlier on, she was afraid of the ridicule and the situation and people labeling her as not all there or having, you know, issues with her mental health or something, and kind of the situation in regards to getting divorced from your father, and therefore she was very careful that she didn't want to give anybody ammunition to use against her, I would imagine, at that situation. So for you, as a toddler and a young child, to be dealing with this and just to have it brushed off as exaggeration or making things up for attention, I would imagine that just made the whole situation far much more worse than it would do for somebody who would normally be going through such situations for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, you know, most of the really malicious activity was at my stepmother's condo. So, you know, like I said, every night I was just tormented and I was, you know, constantly walking into their room at night, you know, saying, hey, can I sleep with you guys? Can someone come sleep? Can stay with me? You know, when someone stayed in the bedroom with me, they would eventually relent. They would come and lay down. The activity stopped as long as I had someone with me. So I knew if I got someone in the bedroom, you know, laying on my bed with me, or if I went to sleep with them, I would be, you know, I would sleep better. And I was safer. My mother, you know, again, I didn't think, and I look back to this thing of what the hell was wrong with me. I didn't think to actually tell her about all this stuff. You know what I mean? Because again, I kept second guessing myself, thinking, okay, I'm crazy. Mm. And I didn't realize, you know, I did not realize that the world, like I said, and my mom's, you know, where she did, she wasn't a tarot reader, but she did psychometry, at times, but she was a well-known psychic in the area that we lived in. And she never, you know, it was just strange because it was just something that mom did. She had a daycare. She took care of kids during the day. And then at night when she, you know, when she was by herself or with me there, she would have reading. She would get up, you know, like that. She would send the kids home with their parents, you know, after a long day, and she would go take a shower, get ready. She'd make a coconut custard pie. She, you know, very Southern, you know, you don't ever have to ask about food. You don't ever be mad, you know. And she had her sweet tea and her coconut custard pie all ready to go. And, you know, she'd send me to the bedroom because I wasn't allowed to be running around and playing. So she sent me out to the bedroom and I went to the, you know, back bedroom and just kind of read and watched TV, did my own thing. And then she would sit in the living room with people and read them. And I remember, you know, quite a few times poking my head out of the door, you know, real discreetly and having, you know, the person going, oh my God, how'd you know that? You know, she would just really wow people. So I don't know to this day. I even think back, like, why didn't I go to my mom? Because she was the fiercest protector I ever had, even later in life. You know, she was my cheerleader. She was my protector. She protected me a lot from a lot of things because she was very formidable spiritually. And I do recall a time when I kind of put two and two together, but still I didn't quite understand, where I was about 6 years old and it occurred to me that my father, who was in law enforcement, could die. Mm. And I don't know why that hit me at six. But it hit me, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And it hit me in a way that didn't seem normal. It almost seemed kind of paranormal in a way, because I obsessed over this. I started, you know, I was a little six-year-old little kid, and I'm sitting there literally obsessing all day long. Oh my God, my dad's gonna die, my dad's gonna die. And then at night, I had the same reoccurring nightmare for 2 weeks straight. Every single night for 2 weeks straight. And I didn't tell a soul about this because I thought people would laugh at me. So I didn't say anything. And every night for 2 weeks, I struggled. And then I couldn't, you know, during the day, I was tired and I wasn't sleeping at night. And I just utterly tormented. And I really didn't know what to do about it. I kept suffering with it quietly. One night, after about 2 weeks of this, my mother, being the super psychic that she was real sensitive. She was looking at me across the table and a kind of a, she had her hand on her face and she just kind of squinting, looking at me like I thought it was a trouble or something. I thought, oh crap, what'd I do? And so, but she was looking at me and she goes, just point blank. She goes, for the last 2 weeks, you've been having dreams of your dad dying. And she described the dream perfectly. And basically I had a dream where I was holding a picture when we had pictures, actual paper pictures to look at. Hmm. And I was holding a picture and so that dates it. No camera phones here, but I remember I was looking at him holding a picture of my dad's tombstone and my father's name was on it. And there was like this really thick green grass around it. And every single night I had this nightmare and I would wake up in, you know, cold sweat and everything. But she called that nightmare out. She said, every single night you've been having dreams of your dad dying, and this is the dream. You're standing there, hold the picture, and you're dreaming of your dad's tombstone with his name on it. There's really green grass around it. And as a six-year-old kid, this floored me, you know, because I never really understood what mom did. You know, she talked to people. She held a piece of their jewelry, or she looked at a picture. And then she said things and then they freaked out. That's all I knew. You know, I didn't know what was going on. And she called it out right there. And I was like, oh, this is what mom does. This is what she does. She knows, she knows things. And it was very interesting because as soon as she called it out, I never had that nightmare again.
It is very interesting. And I think this is one of the aspects of the book that I found interesting is the fact that you were both clearly sensitive to things that were going on around you. And it's almost as if neither of you wanted to talk to the other one about how you felt, because I know as you go through the book in your life, as we've touched on before, it's when you become a teenager and you and your mum start talking about these situations. Do you think your mum was concerned that you also, not that it's, you know, some people would say it would be a concern, MG, I'm not saying it is, but do you think she was concerned that you also had the gift and she was hoping that it was just a phase you were going through? Or was it the fact that you didn't, because you'd had such a negative response when you were stopping at your father's and his stepmother's and your stepmother's, that you were so used to being pushed away and told that you were just making things up that you didn't want to go to another adult and hear the same thing again?
You know, I don't think my mom really told me about stuff like that because she didn't really think to. You know, some people, they grew up with their mom or their grandma or an aunt, and they, you know, sat them down and taught them how to do tarot cards or something. And my mom never did that with me. She never thought about it. She never, you know, I do remember her talking about auras, and I remember she actually could see people's auras, especially like in a sort of like a sim, like a dimly lit room. Mm. And she could actually see people's auras. And so she tried to get me to see it. And of course I was so, yes, I was sensitive, but yet I was kind of reluctantly sensitive. You know what I mean? I wasn't trying to learn this stuff. I think for me, I was just trying to get through life. You know, I was bullied as a kid. I was just trying to fit in and, you know, not get tortured at school all day. You know what I mean? So I wasn't really thinking much along these lines. And my father and his wife weren't really into it, you know? So I just didn't think much about it. And she didn't think much about it. It was just kind of her thing. It's what she did. She that's the life she lived. And she didn't, really share it much with anyone. She just kind of did her own thing. She had her own circle of friends that would, they would come together, they would kind of do seances, or they would do trance work on each other. She had a teacher named Tony Liggett, and he was from London.
Mm.
And he's got an article in I think the National Enquirer called Dear Tony. And still to this day. So he's very, helpful with people. He's still at it, but my mom studied under him, and he told her at one point, he said, I can't teach you anything else. You've surpassed the class. You're very powerful. So my mom just kind of, you know, like, it's a did her own thing. I remember one time she told me she went to a psychic fair and she was doing readings there, and there was some sort of local election about, it was like some kind of mayor or who was going to be mayor or something like that. And out of all the psychics, she was the only one that was right. So, you know what I mean? It was just kind of something she did. She never really shared it with me until I started to talk to her about it. I started getting older and I started cluing in, and I said, Mom, we're sensitive. This is what we do. And this is who we are. And she's like, yeah, she's like, yeah, that's, you know. And she knew I was sensitive. And then I started kind of growing into it. It wasn't until I was in my teens that I started to realize I was picking up on things, and that's when I knew I could go to her, because I knew those worlds were connected at this point. It took me a long time to figure it out, but I finally did. And I remember, you know, as a teenager, I kind of would go to my mom and say, Mom, I saw this. I felt that. I've heard this. And she's like, yeah, I heard it too. Or yeah, I felt that too. I saw it too. It's just something that I kind of hit later in life. And once we started talking, though, we started realizing that we saw the same things and felt the same stuff. And so we kind of banded together in that way. You know, we would, people saw that we were very, not to brag, but saw that we were pretty powerful. And so they said, hey, can you come over and, you know, cleanse this space? You know, there was office buildings or houses or plots of land that were, you know, according to them, haunted or cursed. And so my mom and I would go over to those places, or even with people. You know, my mom would go and someone asked her to pray for them, and she'd start praying for people. She was so sensitive that she could go, she was in the grocery store, you know, and someone would walk past her and she was like, I think I need to tell that lady something. And I'm like, well, go tell her, you know. And she was always so embarrassed, but she did. And she was always right. You know, the person would be like, oh my gosh, thank you for telling me that. Or how did you know that? Oh my gosh. You know, so my mom never, the gift, the ability, whatever you want to call it, it never waned in her. It was always strong. And I think one time she did express to me that she was scared that I might go through something. It might be too much of a burden for me. You know, she was scared that, you know, I might not, it might be too much for me, but, you know, in my lifetime, but, you know, I've been doing okay. You know, I mean, I'm learning even now, I don't think we ever fully get there. There is no sort of destination, but I think I'm at a place now where I'm, you know, I'm almost 45 and I'm pretty sensitive to stuff. And I think I got a pretty good handle on it now. You know what I mean? I know how to cut it. There's no ever, when you have ESP and you have an antenna, it's always on. It's always up. It's always on. There's no real on or off switch. I tell people all the time, it's more like a dimmer switch. You can kind of push it down, push it away, not think about it, focus on what you got to do for that day. And then it always seems to kind of bounce back, though. You know what I mean? So there's no ever getting rid of it. I don't think you could ever really get rid of it. I think you can kind of quiet it down a little bit by focusing on what's right in front of you physically. But I don't think there's never been a time where I've been able to really shut it off. I mean, even if I'm not experiencing hideous paranormal activity, you know, really intense stuff, I am at some point picking up on someone. I know when someone's going to call me. I know when someone's going to email. I know when someone's talking about me behind my back. I know when something's going to happen. You know, lately my dog has been sick, and I've been, you know, intuitively, I've been really tuning in, and I've been hearing like, nope, he's going to be okay, or nope, give him this, don't give him that, do this, do that. And I have a, you know, a friend that's just like, I'm amazed. He knows I'm psychic. He knows I'm sensitive, but he's like, I'm amazed at your intuition and how you knew to give him this and not that and this and that and all this stuff. So he's like, I'm pretty impressed with this, you know, because he knew I was psychic or sensitive, but he didn't understand it until I, you know. And I said, well, I told you I was sensitive, you know, this, you know. So he's seen it firsthand now. But yeah, I mean, my mom and I, it wasn't something until like later in my years when I finally clued in, and then we kind of became a team. We worked together and we hopefully helped a lot of people, you know?
Yeah. I think it's also interesting when you look at that section of your book, that's when you seem to become comfortable in your own skin, MG. And I think that's when you suddenly realized that you weren't the only person that had these experiences. You weren't strange. You weren't weird. This was normal for people of your ilk. And I think when you're talking about that aspect of your life in the book, you seem to grow as a person. You seem to become more confident in yourself. And obviously with the situations that were going on, you know, inside your family units, that you'd got to a certain point where you just drew a line in the sand and went, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not putting up with this anymore. And you seem to change from that point onwards. Because I think you've got the confidence and you realize that you weren't alone. You weren't the only person. And other people did have these experiences.
Yeah. There came a time when I think I'd seen so much and I kind of got to a place where I was not easily scared. Mm. You know, there comes a time when you kind of grow up here. And you've seen so much and you've been through so much and you get pretty tough and not much scares you. And that's kind of how I was. I was just kind of like, yeah, no, not scared. You know, and anytime I had anything come at me, whether it be, you know, just weird feelings or something demonic, I just knew that I, you know, they can't harm me. they can't hurt me. And so you get to the point where you're not really scared by these things. You're more annoyed by them, you know, and that's kind of how I got. I just kind of got like it was like a fly, like shoe fly, you know. And so now, like I was telling you before, you know, anytime I have a paranormal encounter and something somewhat nasty tries to come at me, I'm just kind of like shoe fly, you know what I mean? Like, get out of here. Come on, get out of here. Don't waste my time. Or I look at him, I'm like, I don't have time for this crap. Go bother someone else, you know. And so I shoot them away and I literally have seen quite a few entities get like disappointed at the fact that, you know, they can't bother me. And it's like, sorry, I've seen it. I've seen it all. You, what are you going to do? Come at me and the darkness? I've seen it. I've seen that, you know, you're not coming at me with anything new. So get lost, you know?
I mean, there's a couple of the other characters that you encountered in your childhood that I'd like to touch on, if that's all right. There's one that really creeped me out, which you describe as this horrible little imp-like creature that's hissing at you, that it seems it was trying to suffocate you at one point, and you had to sort of fight it off. That is an extremely creepy encounter. I have to say, it gave me goosebumps.
Yeah, no, I've had a handful of really quite terrifying encounters of entities that literally physically overtook me. I was about 8 years old. Like I said, it was right before my father divorced wife number two and moving on with wife number three. And I remember I was getting to the point where I was really getting still terrified, but I was annoyed too. And I remember one night I had, you know, just most of the night I was tormented by something. I constantly was bothered by just whatever it was, pulling the sheets off the bed, kicking the bed. I heard a weird noise. I finally got so creeped out. I know something was in the room with me and I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm done. And so I left the bedroom and I went to lay on the bed, or not the bed, the couch, the sofa in the living room, because it was very close to my parents' room. So I thought, well, if anything happens, I could just run in there and get them, because I was that creeped out. So I left the bedroom, went and laid on the sofa. The parents' bedroom was open, so that was good. And I would get in trouble if I was on the sofa. So I remember thinking, well, if their alarm goes off, because it was almost ready to get up. Maybe 2 hours or so. It's about 5 or so in the morning. So I remember thinking, okay, if their alarm goes off, I'm going to jump up and run to the bedroom and pretend like I was in there the whole time. So I did that. I laid down thinking, okay, I'm going to get, you know, at least a couple hours sleep. Hopefully I'm a little bit safer out here. And that was like the stupidest thing that I could have done, because I was not any safer. I was in the same house. I don't know what I was thinking, but I was eight, whatever. So I remember laying there, and I no sooner closed my eyes when all of a sudden something jumped on me, and I woke up, and I could barely open my eyes, and I couldn't breathe almost instantly. And I remember there was something on me. I could feel the actual weight of it. It wasn't that tall. It was maybe 3 feet, 4 feet. And I, and I'm a tiny little kid, you know, I'm pretty scrawny. So I'm laying there and I immediately feel the weight of something. I feel a hand or something over my eyes, and I feel something over my nose and mouth. So I can't scream and I can't breathe. And I'm laying there just bewildered, terrified, shocked. I mean, I could not, I was 1 minute asleep. The next minute, here I am tortured, and I'm literally just, I'm going to be killed. This thing is going to kill me. It's trying to, you know, it's trying to suffocate me. And I remember literally I could open my eyes a little bit, and I can remember seeing something over my eyes. And I remember seeing like underneath where my nose is, I could see like underneath the hand, I guess, where I literally could see no body, but yet I could feel the weight of it.
Mm.
And so but there was something over my eyes and over my nose and mouth. So I'm struggling to scream, struggling to breathe. And whatever this thing was, it was pure hatred. And it was on top of me, and it was hissing, kind of like it's like a cornered animal, like a cornered possum or something. It was hissing in my face. It was just hissing, growling, snarling right in my face. I could feel the breath on my face. And this thing just, all I could get was just, it was pure evil, and it hated me, and it was going to kill me. Hmm. And I remember not having a clue. I was running out of air, freaking out, not having a clue as to what to do. And I heard in my head, reach up and grab it by its arms and throw it off. And I'm like, well, does this thing even have arms? I don't know. You know, I couldn't see it. But I remember reaching up instinctively. I reached up, and I felt little spindly arms in my hands. And I remember grabbing it, and I remember thinking, all right, that's it, I'm getting rid of you. And I remember grabbing it and throwing it down and having it hissing and snarling as it ran away. And I remember looking, getting up, you know, catching my breath, you know, just completely stunned. Mm-hmm. I remember jumping up and looking all around, looking behind the couch, under the couch, like, where is this thing? Because I couldn't see it, but it was there. There was something there. It was invisible. And I remember just laying there, just completely bewildered, shocked, stunned, kept trying to catch my breath, and just, what the hell was that? And I remember not sleeping for the rest of the night. I sat there. Like I said, I had to get up around like 7:30, but I remember throughout 5:30 or so, and I remember just sitting on the couch with my knees, you know, hugging my knees, just kind of just like sitting there going, what the hell was that? And is it going to come back? And I wasn't about to go to sleep, and I was terrified. I remember going to school thinking, is it going to come back? What's going to happen? You know, that was one of the top three most terrifying encounters I ever had. Was something so, it was tiny, but it was strong, and it, because it was holding me down, and it was vicious, and just absolute pure evil. And I don't know what it was to this day.
It is. And one of the things that strikes me is that you've had a lot of incidents where it's a one-off, MG. These things, like this particular incident, often when people are tormented, they will talk about the Hat Man or shadow people or something. There seems to be a uniformity to them that, you know, it's the same thing that keeps coming back and back and back. Whereas you've had two or three notable encounters with weird things. This is one of them. The one that made me sit up and take notice was what you referred to as the chasers, which would sort of run up to you, kind of surprise you, and then just follow you around wherever you went.
Yeah, these things, again, I did not see them, but you know how, like, when someone walks up behind you and they're not saying anything and they're standing right behind you, and you know someone's right behind you, you could feel it, like the, you know, your gut instinct or your, you know, sort of lizard brain, something picked up on it, and you turn around, you're like, what are you doing? You know, someone is right behind you. It's kind of like that. You could pick it. I picked it up as something like that. And I remember, you know, all throughout my years, I'd be in the kitchen, getting food, and all of a sudden I could feel what felt like an American football player, you know what I mean? Like a quarterback, like a big thing running up to me, rushing up to me. I could feel the wind and I could feel something standing right there, to the point where I was like, okay, okay, okay. And I would run out of the kitchen. I remember being at my grandma's house and being in, you know, in the, I was in the linen closet and I was getting cough drops. And I remember something rushing up to me and almost knocking me up to my feet. And I just ran into the kitchen, and they, of course, they were like, what's happening? And I couldn't say anything because they wouldn't believe me. So, and then I remember later in my life when I was at, my dad's house, we had built a house. And I remember there was this back bedroom that was just very creepy because there was something on the property. And I remember just feeling like something would run up behind me. And if I didn't run, this thing was going to get me. And I remember a couple of times I would fall. I felt like I was, you know, I would trip and I would fall, or I would, you know, turn around really quickly. And I could just, for all the world, I could feel whatever it was like, yeah, I'm chasing you. What are you going to do about it? You know, and it was just, you know, I mean, just, you can't see it, but, you know, of course I had this built-in spirit communication thing because I'm a medium. So I would pick up on whatever this was, couldn't see it, thought it was crazy because I'm very logical, very analytical. And so if you can't see it, well, it's not really there, right? Well, on the other hand, I can pick up on these things. So I knew something was there, but yet I couldn't see it. So the one hand I'm thinking I'm crazy, and the next minute I'm like, nope, something's definitely there. So I was struggle between my mind and my gut all the time. I still do, you know, and I mean, the whatever these things were just loved me right on my heels. I don't know why they got joy in torturing me.
Yeah, clearly something was enjoying freaking you out as much as they did. And it's a very strange thing. I think one of the really interesting experiences that you describe in the book is when you are overcome, as you touched on earlier, you were terrified when you were around six of your father being killed or dying. And yet later in your life, you suddenly became overcome with this awful feeling that something bad had happened to your dad. And I found that very interesting because obviously it was connected to your father, but it wasn't what you perceived it to be. And I found that a very interesting aspect, primarily because of the relationship you had with his, I think that was his second or your second stepmom, MD, that you'd had this very difficult, to say the least, we'll not spoil it for anybody that's not read about it, but to say it was a challenging relationship would be an understatement, I suspect. And I found it very odd that you get overcome with this emotional bombshell that you seem to think something awful's happened to your dad. It has, but perhaps not in the way you would think.
Yeah, there was a time I had lived with my father and his third wife, my second stepmother, and it was a very abusive household. And I remember leaving, I finally escaped, and I went to live with my mom again. And I'm living with my mom, and we're out in the backyard. And at this point, I had, you know, really gone through a lot. I'm having anxiety attacks daily, just really tormented, you know, by the years of abuse that I have been through. A lot of PTSD. Complex post-traumatic stress disorder, and was just trying to make sense of my world at this point. You know, I'm a teenager and I'm not in a war zone every day, you know, so I'm, you know, kind of getting used to not being tortured all the time. And I'm standing out in the backyard, and I had talked to my father at this point. I had, you know, started talking to him again, but, you know, I wasn't living there, thank God, but I was with my mom. We're out in the backyard, and I remember we were talking about just regular mundane things. And all of a sudden I get a rush of terror and fear. And in my mind, I see my father and I see an ambulance, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And then I screamed. I literally had this vision, this premonition of my father and ambulance and just an absolute terrifying feeling. So I screamed at my mom. I said, mom, call dad, something's wrong. And at first she thought I was just having an anxiety attack. And I said, no, something's wrong. this isn't an anxiety attack. This is something else. And I kept getting the same image. I saw my dad's face. I saw an ambulance. Something's wrong. Something's wrong. So after like 10 minutes of me screaming at her, we're like, oh, she's like, okay, okay. So we went in the house. My mother called his office, and one of his coworkers literally hangs the phone up on her, and she calls back. She's like, he hung up on me. She got so mad. She calls back. She goes, don't you dare hang up on me. She said, where is he? And the guy, my father's coworker, said, he's heading to the hospital right now. His wife just got in a car accident. And I guess I picked up on that. I picked up on my dad. I knew when my dad was having a stroke. I knew when my dad was going through something. I know when my dad, you know, I very, very tuned into my father. So I always know, you know, when he's going through something, especially when it's something scary. And I, you know, I picked up on that. And sure enough, my mom found my dad, talked to him. He said his wife at that time was, had been hit by a truck, and she was in her car, and she was being airlifted to the hospital, and he was on his way to the hospital. And so, yeah, I picked up on that.
Yeah. I find it very interesting that it was how your dad was feeling that sort of triggered that, and obviously all the emotions and fear and worry that would come along with that, because unfortunately your second stepmother passes away due to the injuries she sustains in the crash, I believe, which kind of leads you down the road to something that seems to occur further on in life. But I find it's very interesting that regardless of everything that you'd been through and the situations and the problems that you'd had in that particular part of your life and the relationship he was in, that you were still so attuned to him that you were able to feel those emotions from wherever they come from, MG, that they connected with you and realized that he was going through something extremely traumatic at that point.
Yeah. You know, again, to this day, I don't really know why I'm so tuned in to my dad, but I always, like I said, you know, years and years later, my father one night was he had a stroke, and instead of calling me, he calls his dating a woman at that point, and he calls her, and I was right down the road, and he called her, and she was like almost an hour away. And I'm like, why didn't you call me? You know, but I knew he was going through something. It was around 10, 11 at night. And I thought, I kept saying my dad, and I'm like, should I call him? Should I bother him? I don't want to bother him. He's probably asleep. And I didn't call him. And then sure enough, the very next morning I get a phone call from her, the wife or the girlfriend, saying, okay, don't freak out, but your dad's in the hospital. He had a stroke last night around 10:30. And I said, damn it. I knew it. I knew it. I saw his face and I knew something wasn't right with him. And I talked to my dad. I said, why did you call me? You know, why did you call her? But, yeah, I was really stunned. You know, again, I always know when he's going through something. I keep seeing his face, and I always know when he's going to contact me too. He sends me little emails. And so every once in a while I'll see his face and I'll get an email. I'm like, yep, there's Dan, you know.
I found it quite funny that eventually, after all this and everything that's happened, he finally opens up that he'd himself had some paranormal encounters as well. That he seems to have been one of those people that, obviously, with everything that you'd gone through and the fact that you were consistently told that you were just imagining it, or you were just doing it for attention, or just trying to, you know, throw a spanner in the works of a new relationship. Perhaps that was the perception that they were viewing your problems with, MG. It's interesting that eventually he comes clean and tells you that actually he's had a couple of things happen to him that frightened him as well.
Yeah, my dad, you know, he doesn't talk much. But, and you got to kind of pull stuff out of them. So I remember kind of like, Dad, have you ever been through a paranormal encounter? And he laughed. He said, well, I've had a few weird things. You know, he finally admits to it. But this is not in the book. This is like a little extra tidbit. But my father, when he was in law enforcement, he was in drug enforcement, you know, drug, you know, sort of that sort of branch of it. And so he and, you know, his colleagues, they did a seizure of a house. There was a house that was supposed, you know, they were doing surveillance on, And they were watching this one house, and they, of course, they came in just much like the, you know, the cop shows that you see when they bash the door in and they come running in. that's what my dad did. So he went into this house, and it was mostly Hispanic folks in this house. And of course he and his colleagues, he said that whenever they found a drug house where they were hiding drugs, he would have to take pictures of the walls and the ceiling. They had to take picture of every single inch of that house. And so he said, you know, the people that were there practiced Santeria. And so there was several altars, you know, shrines, whatever you want to call them, to send Orisha or saint. And so he went up to one of these altars, and one of them was towards the, well, one of the altars was for an Orisha called Elewa. And so there was a little bowl of pennies. That's Elewa. Anytime you find a bowl of pennies, or you get pennies to Elewa. So my father went up to the bowl, and he stirred up the bowl of pennies, which is a big no-no. You don't do that. So the people in the house, of course, being, you know, irreverent, like they were like, don't do that. No, he hates that. Don't do that. But my dad was being a jerk, and he stirred the bowl of pennies because he could. And, you know, there's typical jerky, you know, cop behavior. So anyway, my dad did that. And of course, when he's telling me this, of course, I know exactly what's going on. So I'm like, Dad, don't ever do that. He's like, well, I was being a jerk. I said, yeah, I know, clearly. So anyway, on this altar, there's several little shelves above the actual altar that have statues, depictions of the Orishas. So my father and his colleague, they were taking pictures of the altar, which you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to take pictures of sacred spaces in Santeria like this. You're not supposed to take pictures of the saints. It's very private. And so you're not supposed to take pictures. But again, here they were taking pictures because, of course, it was protocol. They had to. So they drop off the film. You know, again, no camera phone. So they drop off the film. They get the pictures back. And my father takes out the pictures, and he's absolutely flabbergasted. And he's like, remember those statues that were on those shelves that we were taking pictures of? And everyone's like, yeah. And he's like, they didn't show up in the picture. So my father, you know, it was like the Rishas kind of showed my dad, like, hey, look, we're very powerful. Don't mess with us. So they didn't allow themselves. They weren't supposed to be photographed, and they didn't allow themselves to be photographed. And literally the photos showed shelves that were empty. And none of the statues were on there. And several of my father's coworkers freaked out and ran out of the office because they didn't even want to see the pictures, because they were like, no, I know the statues were there because I took one of those pictures. And yeah. So anyway, that was that was one of my dad's paranormal encounters.
I found it very interesting as well in regards to your mum, that she has this memory of what she thinks is a very vivid dream, where she has a dream, or she says it's a dream, of an encounter with some kind of grey, I would imagine we could describe it as almost as if she's in some kind of abduction scenario. How old were you when your mum broached this memory that she thinks is just a very vivid dream? Because how she describes it, it does sound like a very typical abduction experience.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had to break that to her after a while. I was like, Mom, that wasn't a dream. And she didn't want to hear it. She's like, no, it was a dream. Don't tell me that. She didn't want to hear it. But I said, Mom, no, you were actually abducted. So I was just, I don't even remember. I was very little when she told me about this dream. And it stayed with me because it scared her so bad. She shook. And my mother's, you know, very tough lady, spiritually formidable. And this thing scared the crap out of her. And I remember what she told me scared me as well. Because I remember saying, I don't want no UFO encounters after what I heard. But she basically said that back in, it was like, oh gosh, it was probably 1968. This was before Star Trek even. She lived in a little tiny apartment in San Diego with my dad and my two older siblings, and they were little. And she remembers being aboard a craft. And she remembers this very tall gray, very tall. My mom was 5'6", so this gray towered over her. But this gray was very tall. She got the impression it was a female, and she got the impression that it was higher ranking than all the other grays. And this gray that was showing her around had a long blue tunic on. And she said it looked like a robe in a way. And it tied, you know, it looked like a bathrobe, basically, and then tied, and it had belt sleeves. And it was a shimmery blue tunic, she said. And she said the material looked like nothing she had ever seen on Earth. And my mother used to make my siblings' clothes. So she was fairly familiar with material and whatnot, fabric and stuff. And she said it looked like it was made out of metal. And she said this gray put something in her hand. It was like the size of a coaster, you know? And she said it looked like it had kind of something similar to the seal of the United States on the back of an American dollar. And, you know, with the eagle and the shield and the arrows and the olive leaf, you know, olive branch. And she saw this and she kind of exclaimed to the gray. She said, oh, that's kind of like what we have at home. And then her next memory is her and this gray were in a lift and the doors open like Star Trek. They go, psh, and they opened to this dimly lit room. And she said the room was real smooth. There was no knobs or levers or buttons or handles, nothing protruding. Everything was brushed metal, very smooth. And she said this gray walked over. She would just stand in there. This gray walked over to, I guess, the control panel and waved. And my mom said with its long, skinny fingers, waved its hand over this control panel. When it did, the entire ship powered up, the room lit up, like everything turned on. And when my mother saw this, she snapped out of her sort of dreamlike stupor, which I've kind of confirmed with Terry Lovelace. If you don't know who he is, look up Incident at Devil's Den. You know, he's got quite an encounter story. So he said, yeah, that's the same thing. They, you know, a lot of abductees claim to have this sort of dreamy, awestruck kind of, you know, thing about them. So when my mother saw this gray wheel, this sort of power to where it could turn on, it powered its own ship. She said she came unglued and she started screaming. She started, I want to go home. I want to go home. You know, I don't want to be here. I'm scared. I'm scared. I don't want to be here. And she said the gray was very kind and reassuring to her and said, look, you're in no danger. We're not going to hurt you. No harm's going to come to you. You're fine. And for some reason, that just was not sitting well with my mother. You know, like it didn't make a dent, really. Yeah. She was just like, no. I want to go home. I don't want to be here. I'm terrified. And so she remembers, I guess, passing out or something. But she remembers waking up, sitting up in her bed. And she remembers jumping up like she came to. She jumped up and there was a window behind the bed of my behind, you know, on the wall behind their bed. And she jumped up and parted the curtains to see if there was a craft outside. So she, you know, had some sort of memory of a craft and she thought the craft would be out there. And she remembered she kept telling herself that that was a dream. It was a dream. And then she remembers, you know, many years later when Close Encounters came out and she saw it, she freaked out because she was like, oh, my God, that's what I saw. Because at that point, grays like we know them weren't really vernacular. They weren't everyday talk. So that sort of alien wasn't really well known unless it was to an abductee. So my mom really freaked out over the years because she was like, how did, you know, because one minute she would say, oh, that was a dream. And then the next minute she would say, yeah, but how did I know what a gray was before I even saw a gray? And then years later, we were in a bookstore and she saw Whitley Strieber's Communion.
Yes.
in the gray on the front of the book. And I remember she got so freaked out. I had to push her out of the bookstore because she was starting to go into a panic attack. She was like, that's what I saw. That's what I saw. And, you know, it really disturbed her. And many years later, 40, 50 years later, I would ask her about it. And she would still shake, you know, and I saw my mom face off against all kinds of stuff. You know, nothing scared this woman, but this one quote unquote dream terrified her.
I find that quite telling that she has still such an emotional response to it. As you mentioned there, Terry, I was very fortunate to speak to Terry about a year ago, and his experiences is quite a heartbreaking story on a number of levels. MG, as how it's affected him as a person, how it changed his life, how he lost his best friend. On top of everything else that he went through, it's one of those stories that just blows you away. And he's such a humble and thoughtful man that he's taken it upon himself to speak with other people and make them feel that they aren't alone and they have got a safe space to talk about that. Because I think, as you say there, you know, kind of pulling your mum's leg, saying, I don't think that's a dream. It would be very interesting because, as you say, Greys at that point were not well established in ufology. I remember when I made the mistake of reading Communion on holiday as a teenager, where we were staying, somebody came up, emptied the bottle bin at 5 a.m. while we were on holiday. And I woke up like somebody let a gun off in the bedroom.
Oh, no.
Because you just hear all these bottles smashing. You're like, what the hell? And thankfully, I was able to see the bin lorry out. So, well, I thought it was a bin lorry. You never... So it's remarkable how when you talk about people like your mum and the experiences that they had, you know, these were not established members of the UFO community. Most people in that point were talking about encountering tall humanoids or robots more than anything. So
yeah.
it's unusual that your mum still had such an emotional response to a dream as she had filed that away. And I would imagine perhaps for her own best interests.
Yeah, I think she even talked about that. She said, you know, the aliens of her time, you know, back in the 50s and 60s were still the clunky robots that would come out of the, you know, spaceship, or the ant people, you know, the ants that is them or something like that. But, it, you know, there were all these silly looking, and even with Star Trek, you know, there were these silly looking aliens.
Yeah.
With like blue faces or, you know, weird antenna or something coming on their head and, you know, just silly stuff. But my mom, you know, through the years, you know, she would 1 minute say, oh yeah, that was a terrible dream. But then the next minute you would see her face and she would say, but how did I know what a gray was before anyone else, you know? Yeah. And Close Encounters, every time she saw it, because, you know, it comes on TV all the time. Every time she saw it, she was like, yeah, that's what I saw. That's what I saw.
Yeah, absolutely. Goodness me. I mean, in regards to how your life is now, MG, have you kind of made peace with yourself? Because it would seem that sort of over the last 10 years or so, as you were saying earlier on, you've kind of told these entities where to go when they turn up these days, and you know, you give them short shrift. Do you think that that's part of you becoming more comfortable as an adult and just dealing with this and just thinking, I've had a lifetime of this. I'm sick to the back teeth of these entities and bothering me all the time. And it's allowed you to kind of grow as a person and just be who you want to be rather than this small, scared child that was having to deal with these paranormal bullies.
Yeah. You know, I think, I don't know, in my case anyway, the older I got, the more I learned, the more I realized that a lot of these entities, they're only as powerful as you let them, you know, they're bullies. Mm. And, you know, if you dealt with bullies at school or at work or in your neighborhood, you realize that you at some point have to stand up to them. Is it scary? Yes. Is it important? Is it essential? Yes. Because you have to take your power back. You got to take your life back. Bullies are only as strong as you really let them be over you. And so you have to take your power back. You have to say no more. You may be able to punch me in the face, but I am not going to cower anymore. And that's the same thing with paranormal bullies. You know, after a while, I started to realize who I was and who they were, and that I was on some levels more powerful than they are. And I was, you know, on one hand, in a sort of Christian sense, I was not going to take the crap. And then when I kind of came out of the Christianity, churchy Christianity stuff, you know, I still believe in God. I'm not anti-Christian, but when I came out of that and started to see how other people dealt with paranormal bullies, whether it be, you know, St. Michael pendants or holy water or blessed salt or sage or, you know, whatever, this prayer, this chant, this thing, you know, when I saw other people with other means and methods of dealing with paranormal bullies, I then realized, oh, okay, I'm on this side of it. They're on, you know, these paranormal bullies entities are on this side, and there's ways to defeat them. You don't have to put up with them. And, you know, so I kind of, like I said, I grew up here and I realized, okay, they're only as powerful as I let them be over me. And I'm not going to let that happen anymore. Not saying that, you know, things still won't try to come at me or you know, what have you, but I'm, you know, pretty formidable at this point myself. And I just, you know, I just kind of, again, you know, realize that if you take the wind out of their sails, you're no fun. So they leave you alone, a lot of them.
So what's next for you now? I know obviously the book's recently been released at the beginning of this year and is available. So what's next on your agenda? I know you've got a YouTube channel and the like. MG, so are you continuing to develop your skills? Are you trying to learn new facets to your abilities, or are you kind of letting things settle down for a while?
You know, I'm doing a little bit of everything. You know, I try not to stir stuff up, and I'm just kind of hanging out, and I'm just... I believe that, you know, the universe brings opportunities and people across our path that are supposed, you know, I believe everything's fated, everything's destined. So people bring those things across, you know, the universe brings people and things across your path to learn, to grow, to change, to be a better person, to help someone. So that's what I'm all about. And I started my YouTube channel to, you know, give people a safe space to talk about their paranormal encounters and tell their whole story and just get it out. Just a safe space to talk, you know. So, you know, my book can be found at Amazon.com. The podcast can be found at YouTube. If you have any stories you would like to share, you'd like to come on the podcast and just share your stories. It's anonymously, even you don't even have to give your name. It's totally fine. You can reach me on boogeyman chronicles@outlook.com. And I welcome any feedback, any, you know, any stories, anything. You're never going to get judgment with me. And I also do readings. I do a lot of mediumship readings. So I'm open to those. Just contact me. And, you know, I'm just here to help people. I figure if I got this ability, you know, I want to just, you know, use it for good and use it to help people. So if you need, you know, sort of help, or you want to contact someone on the other side, or, you know, they don't even have to be passed on. I can still read them. Mm. So, yeah. So if you need help with anything, give me, you know, write me, drop me a line. And if I can't help you, I know someone who can, you know what I mean? I'll never leave someone hanging. I'm also in the process of writing, two other books. My next book, I really want to focus on, Native American indigenous stories, of the paranormal, because I grew up with a lot of people going, oh, but Native Americans are so much more spiritual. And it's like, yes and no, you know, it's not so much that, it's more like, you know, Native indigenous people, they've never had that sort of break where in sort of non-indigenous cultures, you know, white people mostly, where, you know, once you get to be about 5 years old, there's no more Santa, there's no more, you know, no more Tooth Fairy, there's no more this, there's no more that. And so they take all the fantasy out of life. And so with, you know, indigenous people, we grew up and we don't have that break where, you know, the adults step in and say, okay, this thing doesn't exist, because we're much more connected to that aspect of our lives. You know, the paranormal doesn't get separated from us. It's always there. And so I want to talk about those stories and get it from an Indigenous person's perspective, because I've read so many books about, you know, it's basically a white person talking to a Native person.
Mm.
And getting their stories that way. And I really want to go to the source. So I have several people wanting to contribute to that book. It's called Stories from Turtle Island. So I'm getting that together. And I'm also working on a book about the correlation between neurodivergence and ESP. So if you are neurodivergent and you have ESP, then by all means, write me at Boogeyman Chronicles at Outlook. I would love to talk to you about it and, you know, maybe use your story for the book. And so I'm always writing. I'm always thinking. I'm always, you know, busy. So those are two projects that are coming up right now that I'm working on. So if you have anything to contribute or you just want to talk, by all means, contact me. You know, it might take me a little bit to get back to you, but I will always get back to you. So
fabulous. Well, I'll put links for the book and your YouTube channel and your contact details in the show notes, as I do for all my guests. MG, it's been a real pleasure. And I have to say, reading your story and your life, I found it quite inspiring. And for all the challenges that you've faced, both in the real world and the world of the paranormal, I'm very glad that you're here. And I'm very glad that we've had this conversation. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate it. It's been such an honor and a pleasure to be here. And this was really one of the best interviews I've ever done on this subject. You have such great questions and insights, and I really, really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. You take care.
You too. Thanks so much.